Monarch butterflies are on the move, migrating from the U.S. Northeast to Mexico, as they do every year. It's one of the many extraordinary aspects of butterfly life, an epic journey on seemingly paper-thin wings. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about butterflies, what they are, what they do, and how to tell the difference, finally, between a butterfly and a moth. And joining us are Dr. Bob Robbins, an entomologist and curator of Lepidoptera at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History, and Dr. Cole Gilbert, Associate Professor of Entomology at Cornell University. Welcome to our show.
Hi. Thank you. Pleasure.
Let's begin with you, Dr. Robbins. How long has Lepidoptera been a branch of entomology?
Oh, my. It has been a branch of entomology since the beginning. People have known about butterflies and moths going back to ancient times. The Greeks, the same in the Orient, the same in the Americas. You can look at old, if you look in Mexico and you go to the Tomb of the Moon and the Sun, you can find depictions of butterflies.
Because we like to start these Please Explain segments with very basic definitions, Just what is a butterfly? How does science define butterflies as distinct from other insects?
Oh, my. Well, the simple answer is that a butterfly is active during the day. It's usually colorful, and it has clubbed antennae. But everything in nature has exceptions.
They have four wings, too, don't they?
They have four wings. They do, yes. And what there is a group of butterflies and moths together that your listeners who do crossword puzzles, they probably know them as Lepidoptera, and as you mentioned before. This means wings covered with scales. And as far as I know, all butterflies and moths have wings covered with scales. But what is a butterfly? It turns out to be very complicated. If you think of birds, it's a natural group in that it's a vertebrate animal that has feathers. If it has feathers, it's a bird. If it doesn't, it's not a bird, with perhaps a few exceptions. But what is a butterfly? And we've never actually known for sure. And now, with the advent of being able to look at sequences of DNA, we know that butterflies are what we traditionally call butterflies, plus some moths. They look like moths. They fly like moths. But they're not. They're butterflies. And people first discovered this when they looked at the eggs and the caterpillars of these moths. And they said, my, these look like butterflies. And now, looking at DNA, we can say, yep, it looks like they really are. And the converse is also true. There are some moths that fly during the day. If your listeners go onto their browser and they look for sunset moth, they will see an image of a beautiful, beautiful moth that looks like a butterfly, has clubbed antennae, beautiful, colorful wing pattern. But in fact, it's not related to butterflies at all.
Now, Dr. Gilbert, the moth that Dr. Robbins was talking about is in the Hydatidae family. Am I pronouncing it right?
That's the correct pronunciation for a family of moths, but I think the sunset moth is in a different family.
Okay.
Bob may know that. I think it's in the Uranidae, perhaps.
Yes, it's a Urania moth. That's the technical term for it.
So after all this time, they've just discovered that these sunset moths are actually butterflies. And they had to do a DNA examination to find out. Can't you just look at their bodies and their... I always thought that moths were smaller and not as pretty as butterflies, and that's how you could tell.
Yeah. Sorry, I guess I didn't explain that very clear. The hydatid moths are the ones that are now considered to be butterflies, whereas the sunset moths are actually moths, but when people see them, they think that they are butterflies.
But they're all part of a superfamily.
It is. Butterflies but all the butterflies that had dialids and the butterflies, yes, are generally considered to be a superfamily, but it is yet not entirely clear, even looking at DNA, exactly what should be included.
Now, Dr. Gilbert, what kinds of nervous systems do they have?
So it's basically similar to ours. It's constructed of nerve cells and other supporting cells.
They have brains?
Yeah, they have a brain up in their head, but it's much simpler. And like many other arthropods, they have a little miniature brain in each body segment that typically controls the activities of that segment. So the thorax has three legs and two pair of wings generally, and each thoracic segment has a little mini brain that we call a ganglion that has a concentration of cells that take care of coordination of walking and controlling the angle of the wings.
And what is their vision like? How do they know where they are in space?
Well, their vision, again, to compare it to humans that listeners may be more familiar with, they can see some things better than we can and some things worse than we can. So in terms of color vision, the butterflies can see colors that we can't see. They can see and recognize ultraviolet wavelengths as distinct from blue or purple, and we can't see that at all. They can see polarization patterns in the sky, and we can't see those. But in terms of spatial vision, which is how fine an image they can see, the detail that they can see is very poor compared to what we see with our eyes.
And what do their antennae do for them?
A number of things. They have scent cells. You could think of the antennae as a sort of a combination of nose and fingers. They have scent cells that they can smell the odors of host plants. Females like to pick particular host plants to lay their eggs on. Males can smell the perfume of females, the sex pheromones that they release. But they also serve as fingers. They can tap their antennae and feel surface structure with them. There's even a recent report from moths, although the same may apply to butterflies, that they can use the antennae like little gyroscopes and detect direction of wind and use that to maintain their balance in flight.
Well, butterflies and bees seem to be attracted to similar plants. When I see a butterfly nipping at a butterfly bush in my garden, what is that butterfly doing? It's not collecting nectar to create honey.
No, that's true.
Is it eating?
Yes, it's fueling up. Most of their life is spent in a caterpillar stage where they put on a lot of body fat, energy reserves for the adult. But adults take a little bit of nectar. Think of it as candy bars, kind of quick energy. They may also get a little bit of protein or amino acids from it, but mostly it's sugar that they're getting. And you're right, they don't collect it to make honey as the bees do. They're just fueling up, and they don't particularly take pollen as well.
My guests are Dr. Cole Gilbert, Associate Professor of Entomology at Cornell University, and Dr. Bob Robbins, an entomologist and curator of Lepidoptera at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Dr. Robbins, you mentioned earlier that are daylight insects. Do they sleep? And are there any nocturnal butterflies?
There are some nocturnal butterflies, very, very rare. There are about 20,000 kinds or species of butterflies in the world, so there's a lot of variation. More often, numbers of species are what we call crepuscular. They fly very early in the morning or very late in the day, sometimes between the time the sun goes down and it gets dark.
But moths seem to be out at night. Is that one of the things that separates moths from butterflies?
By and large, it does. But as I mentioned, there are some moths that fly during the day. And if you're going to be active during the day, that means that you can communicate with colors, with light. And so butterflies, in a sense, are a kind of moth that has evolved to specialize to be active during the day. So they use colors, and those moths that fly during the day very often will use colors for communication also.
How long do they live?
As an adult, some butterflies in nature probably have a natural lifespan of maybe a week, some a month, some 6 months, and I think the longest live butterfly is the monarch in North America, which right now is migrating south to Mexico. The ones that are migrating south are not reproductive. They go to Mexico, they spend the winter, they become reproductive, and they start coming north. Some of these individuals apparently can live 9 months or so as an adult.
So, Dr. Robbins, they spend most of their time as caterpillars or in the cocoon, working their way up to becoming butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
That's all done in the north?
With the monarchs, yes.
Are the monarchs the only butterflies that go through that kind of long migration?
No. Most butterflies will overwinter here, and they can spend the winter as an egg, as a caterpillar, as a pupa, which we sometimes think of as cocoons, although technically that's not quite correct. Some of them can even spend the winter as adults. They go into small crevices in bark, say the bark of trees, and they can spend the winter there.
Are they hibernating?
Excuse me?
Are they the equivalent of hibernating?
Very much so, yes.
Well, Cole Gilbert. Yeah, they also can put on antifreeze in their body, just like we put antifreeze in the engine of our cars during the winter to keep the block from cracking. And at the first frost, the butterflies and other insects will secrete these substances so that their body doesn't freeze up and expand, and they'll spend the winter that way.
But the ones that do migrate, like the monarchs, how can they possibly travel all these extraordinary distances with these paper-thin wings?
Go ahead, Cole.
Okay, they're paper thin, but they're relatively sturdy, and they don't flap the entire way. The winds are coming from the north now. Up in New York here, we're getting storms coming from Ontario, blowing south, and so the butterflies can, like monarchs, can travel on a storm front, so they don't have to flap their wings the entire time. And one of the amazing things when you go to the monarch overwintering sites in Michoacán, Mexico, is how good the butterflies actually look. That you occasionally see specimens with relatively ragged wings, indicating that they've flapped a lot or they might be old, but many of them look pristine there. And so really I think maybe that's a little bit of a misconception that the wings are so delicate. They're thin, but I wouldn't say that they're especially delicate.
My guests are Dr. Cole Gilbert and Dr. Bob Robbins. We're talking about butterflies. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org, and we'll be back right after this. Have you ever wondered what makes a great chef? Well, join me on Wednesday, September 26th for the first part of the Low Paid and Locavore series when I talk to world-renowned chefs April Bloomfield, David Boulay, and Mario Batali about the chefs who mentored them and the lessons they had to learn the hard way. That's just the first part of this year's Low Paid and Locavore series. To learn more about all three events and to obtain tickets, visit wnyc.org/thegreenspace, and I hope to see you there. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from Bank Street College Graduate School of Education, helping to transform teaching and learning for all children, hosting a graduate school open house Tuesday, September 11th at 5:15. More at bankstreet.edu/discover. MacArthur Theater in Princeton, presenting Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. Christopher Durang's comedic twist on Chekhov, starring Sigourney Weaver and David Hyde Pierce, September 7th through October 14th. More information at MacArthur.org. Asia Society, presenting Bound Unbound, Lin Tian Miao, the Chinese artist's first major U.S. exhibition, including several new installations and many works never before seen outside of China. More at AsiaSociety.org/NYC. WNYC salutes the arts. Join us in supporting local cultural organizations, including Queens Historical Society, celebrating the borough's diverse history with tours, exhibits, and school programs. Grace Music and NIAC, featuring concerts of classics and new styles and sounds. And Westside Cultural Center, providing environmental and cultural programs through its EcoFest and Taste of Broadway events. For more information about arts in New York, click on the events page at WNYC.org.
From West Nile in Texas to hantavirus in Yosemite, viruses that cross from animals to people are in the news. Hear why today on Science Friday at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. And we are back with Dr. Bob Robbins, an entomologist and curator of Lepidoptera at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History, Dr. Cole Gilbert, associate professor of entomology at Cornell University, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org. And our first caller is Ken from Fairfield, Connecticut.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. I have a question for your guests. We lived in Fairfield for about 25 years, and when we first moved there, we had milkweed in our yard, and we knew to look for eggs of the monarch. And sure enough, we found them the first year we were here, and we helped the birthing process. We fed them, and when they turned to chrysalis and when they came out, we let them go. And over the years, we've been doing this every summer. Our sons taught school, and he would take them to school with him when school started in the early fall. We just wondered, with over the years, we've probably helped birth maybe 200 or 300 butterflies of monarchs. Do they actually know that they came from this area, from this zip code? Do they come back and lay their eggs like they do every summer because of their GPS?
No.
What?
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Okay.
unlike migratory birds that the same individual flies away and then comes back, or the swallows returning to Capistrano, the monarch butterflies that come back in the summer are several generations, I'd say where you live, probably three generations removed from the ones that left in the fall. So they fly down to Mexico, spend the winter in Mexico, and then in February or so, the large roosting areas break up, and they begin their northward migration, turn on their reproductive systems. Bob mentioned earlier that they're shut down for reproduction when they're migrating down there. But in the spring, they turn them on, they mate, and move north to either northern Mexico or the southern Gulf states and lay their eggs there. And then the next generation moves a little bit farther north, and probably by the time they get to Connecticut or Virginia, the next, you know, the third generation from the one that migrated is there.
Now, I've heard that there are fewer monarchs in Mexico these days than there were in the past. Is that because they have been endangered by environmental contamination and being collected?
I think part of the problem in Mexico is that where the monarchs overwinter, they need very specific they have very specific requirements in terms of temperature and humidity, and a lot of the forests in the states of Michoacán and some of the surrounding areas have been cut down by people who need to use the forest to live, and as a result, there's less area for the monarchs to overwinter there, and that is very much a concern.
Do we know when butterflies evolved?
Oh, my. The oldest known butterfly rock fossil is 53 million years old. The second oldest one, which is a swallowtail butterfly from Wyoming, is 48 million years old. And to give you some perspective, the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago.
So did they develop around the same time birds were developing? Because I was wondering if there's a parallel phenomenon of evolution that because we see so many similarities between butterflies and birds. They fly, some migrate, there's tremendous diversity. The males are colorful, the females less so. And it seems like they have similar strategies.
Well, we are slowly, as we find more and more fossils, it's pushing back how old these groups are. But the three of the main groups that fly, the butterflies, the bats, and the birds, their major diversification is the last 65 million years. But when you look at other insects, and of course most insects fly, that goes way, way back, many, many millions of years before that.
A listener, go ahead.
So one of the hypotheses that's out that's being tested is that, as Bob mentioned, that you could think of butterflies as just moths that became diurnal. And the question then is, well, why did they become diurnal and colorful? And a little bit earlier than the time period that Bob mentioned for the oldest fossil butterfly, the bats were evolving. So the little mammals that were taking over after the dinosaurs went extinct evolved wings and got up into the air and put a strong selective pressure on other creatures that were flying around in the air. And many of the moths developed ears so that they could hear the bats hunting for them. And it's possible that some of the moths just became diurnal to escape that predation pressure.
Carol from Teaneck asks, how are butterflies affected by global warming, and are they adapting?
Oh, boy. What a great hot question.
Well,
butterflies, because they have a complex life history as eggs, caterpillars, pupa, and adult, as the climate changes, all of those stages have to adapt. So if, for example, the plants, the flowers that are used as sources of nectar move because of global warming, well, those adults will have to move, but the plants that they are feeding on as caterpillars may move differently. And potentially, and we don't really know very well yet, this is a very active field, we don't really know exactly how this is going to affect butterflies, but what we're beginning to do is come up with those characteristics of species that might be most vulnerable to climate change.
We have a caller from Spain. Marco, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes.
Which part of Spain, Marco?
Oh, I'm in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my question was, I heard that at least one species of butterfly was classified even before it was seen directly, just by looking at a species of flower that had a certain characteristic, so they knew they there had to be a butterfly, and so they were able to classify it before they even saw the first specimen. Is that true, and do you know what species that was?
I think I know to what you're referring. Charles Darwin saw an orchid from the island of Madagascar off the coast of Africa, and it has the corolla, where the nectar is very, very long. And this group of flowers are pollinated by hawk moths, not by butterflies. And so he predicted that a hawk moth would be found that had a proboscis, or tongue, that would be just the length that needed, and it was, I think, 7 or 8 inches, to reach the nectar in that flower. And, in fact, it was discovered many years later.
7 or 8 inches, that's a long tongue for a little moth.
Thank you very much.
It's not a little moth either.
Thank you for calling us, Marco. Since we're talking about moths, we might as well just ask a question that I'm sure so many people have. Ruth from Jersey City.
Yes, I'd like to know what attracts moths to wool.
To wool?
Yes.
Ah.
When I was a kid, we used to have those tar paper things all over our...
And camphor balls.
Camphor balls, or
cedar chests, or cedar closets to hang your clothes in. And there's a... So caterpillars are the larval stage of moths and butterflies, and most of them, by and large, are herbivores. They eat plants, but there are some that eat animal material. They just have evolved to... kind of a slightly different gut to digest the protein in animal material. Some of them are predators, but there's a group of moths that will eat wool, and the caterpillars do quite nicely on it.
Yeah. Along these lines, your listeners might be interested. I once had a phone call from a 5 or 6 year old girl, actually her mother, who called, and she said, "How come the clothes moths don't attack the wool when they're on the sheep?" Which I thought was a mighty good question.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked somebody who's an expert on the clothes moth family, and he said, as Cole had mentioned, that they, the caterpillars, they eat dead organic matter, and usually in dark areas, in caves. You can find them sometimes in the horns of big mammals in Africa, say, after one has died, feeding on the dead matter inside the horns. And so suggested because the sheep are in the sun, in the light, that's why they aren't attacked.
Well, the wool is in the closet.
Several of us have done is we found that if we put wool things in a closet with one of these efficient new light bulbs, and you leave it on all the time, it doesn't get attacked by clothes moths. A very easy way to prevent clothes moths.
Jerry from Briarcliff Manor. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Some of my favorite things are butterflies and hummingbirds. And
but I've heard that the butterflies are among the most popular creatures on Earth, so you're not alone, Jerry.
Okay. Well, I plant in my garden lots of things to attract them. My husband and I have seen a creature twice. Once, I had to be at least 5 years ago, my husband took a picture of it. It was so odd looking, and he's got it as a screensaver. I saw it again last week. I thought it was a hummingbird at first because I've got feeders around, and then I looked closer and I said, "What is that? Is it a moth? It's quite large. It had sort of transparent wings. It looked like it was hovering. Can you tell me anything about it? I mean, this is only the second time I've glimpsed it in 5 years.
Okay, well, Jerry's talking about another large moth. How big do moths grow?
Some of the silk moths, it's a whole group of moths, including the commercial silk moth, can be 10, 11 inches across, very large.
Do butterflies ever get that big?
Excuse me?
Do butterflies ever get that big?
They do. Some of them get 10 inches across, and some of them get very, very long, height-wise, sort of. So both width and height.
We have time
so
to go ahead.
Answer the listener's question, though, I suspect she might be referring to a moth, a couple of species that we call the hummingbird hawk moth. And so it acts like a hummingbird in that it hovers in front of flowers and extends its proboscis into the flower. It's a day-flying moth. It has clear wings. And so this might be the thing that you've seen.
Now, a caller said he saw a monarch butterfly on Broadway today. Is that possible?
Oh, certainly.
Uh-huh.
Sure. They're
on its way south, like the way we see birds as they're flying south?
I think that depends. So up here in central New York, this semester I'm teaching an insect biology class, and we had field trips 3 afternoons this week, and we saw a fair number of monarchs out And I always have the kids take a bearing when they see one flying before they go after it with their net. And they're not particularly flying south here yet.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Great thanks to both of you for talking to us about butterflies in today's Please Explain. Dr. Cole Gilbert of Cornell University, Dr. Bob Robbins of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History. It's been a great pleasure.
A pleasure here also.
On Monday's show, investigative journalist Craig Unger on the stunning return of Karl Rove to a position of power in the GOP. And then Martin Amis on his latest novel, Lionel Asbo. Also, we'll speak to the director and Elizabeth Olsen, one of the stars of a new film called Liberal Arts, about a 30-something New Yorker who returns to his alma mater. Plus, a look at why sound can carry so perfectly in a well-designed opera house. The Let It Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, Melissa Akins, the executive producer. We had help today from Keith Karn, Lindsay Hodges, and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. And I'd also like to thank WNYC's tireless team in Tampa and Charlotte for their great work on the conventions these last 2 weeks. I'm Let It Lopate. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on Monday.